Good afternoon. Before we start our subject matter, I want to make a prefatory comment about questions. I was a little surprised yesterday that there were actual periods of time in which nobody had any questions. That hasn't happened to me before an objectivist audience for 20 years, as far as I can remember. And I talked to several students as to why, and I got various reasons, and I'm trying to now correct the situation. One is, apparently there were a number of people whose hands were up whom I couldn't see, because they didn't move them rapidly enough. So we've now instituted the policy that Diane is going to pick all questions, because she can see hands whether they're moving or not. So she is going to be the one that selects, so that'll solve that problem. Now, the second one is that people told me that they were intimidated because I so narrowly defined what you could ask a question on at any given point that they weren't sure their question was appropriate to that six pages, and therefore they'd rather not ask an irrelevant question. And I can see that that would be a problem, so I am hereby officially dropping the criterion of relevance. In other words, if you if it's a subject that's absolutely in another dimension, like we're talking about the good and you have a question about infinity or the war in Vietnam, that shouldn't be asked. But if you somehow sense or feel that the question on your mind is connected to the subject, even if you couldn't say why or how, ask it. And I will take the responsibility, if it's not relevant, of explaining it. And so the onus will be on me, not on you. So we'll take that impediment away. Now, more broadly, I got the feeling that people were intimidated. At least several people told me that they were afraid of asking bad questions and they'd rather ask no questions. Now, that is a common thing in all audiences, you know, that you don't want to, in front of hundreds of people, ask a question that then reveals that something is wrong with you. And the normal response of teachers or lecturers is to assure people that there are no bad questions, only bad answers, which I'm not going to do, because there are bad questions. There's usually more bad questions than good. But the important point is that you often learn more from asking a bad question than a good one. Because if you have a proper teacher or lecturer, in the act of them explaining why this question is inappropriate or mistaken or comes from a wrong premise, you get invaluable leads as to what's wrong with the direction of your own thinking. And therefore, I know from my own experience that I have learned more from questions that Ayn Rand thought were terrible, not so much from her answer to the question as from her explanation of why I shouldn't have asked it. That happened repeatedly, and she would say, "I'll answer that question only if I can then question you as to why on earth you asked it." And then, you know, she would elicit from me ultimately some premise or approach, usually absorbed in school or college, that I just took for granted. And it was an invaluable learning method. So the fact that your question is labeled as bad is not, if that proves you're no good, then I must be the lowest person in the history of the world, because I could give you 1,000 real life examples in which Ayn Rand got angry at me because of a question that was really bad. Only that was fine with me because I learned a tremendous amount, and that's basically the only way you finally get yourself straightened out. So you can't be afraid of being exposed as a bad question asker. You will never equal the number of bad questions that I ask. So I invite you you just have to have courage if you're learning philosophy. You just plunge in and ask, and if you get denounced, you say, "Oh, okay," and you go on from there. All right, now our topic today is The Good, Chapter 7. And it, I'll give a few words of overview, contains answers to three basic questions, only three. And note that these are the only basic questions of ethics according to objectivism. Everything else, all the material in chapters 8 and 9, is derivative. These are the only three basic, and they have to be answered together as a unit. The answer to any one of these three would not help you have any idea how to live except in conjunction with the other two. The three together constitute the base. Now, the three questions are listed on page 295 in the introduction to the chapter, paragraph 2. The end. For what goal? What should you go after? Second, the means. How should you achieve this end? Now notice the wording. By what principle? Because ethics does not give you details. It doesn't tell you go 3 miles and then turn right and then fill up the tank with gas and so on. But by what principle should you function if you are to achieve this end? And then thirdly and crucially, the beneficiary. For whom should this value be achieved? Now, as I say, no one of these is actually meaningful if stripped apart from the other two. If suppose I said to you, life is the standard, that's the ultimate end, but I gave you nothing more as to the means of achieving it. There was no advice, no content, no hint of what virtue consists of. Well, that would leave open any course of behavior whatever. A person could theoretically, even if that was literally all he knew, commit suicide on what grounds? Well, he's after a higher life, and if life is the standard, he wants an eternal life, not just a temporal life. And after all, you didn't say anything about being rational, so he has no clue as to what to do to achieve life. The same thing is true if you had means but no end. Well, if you don't have an end, how do you know what means? And how do you know what your means mean? You're going to end up like 10 commandments or 100 commandments, which will be arbitrary. They'll be disconnected. There'll be no way to interpret or follow or obey them. And of course, suppose you have means and end. You know what you're after, life. And how, in principle, you're going to achieve it by the exercise of rationality. But you have no clue as to the beneficiary. Then you have no idea, well, whose life? Are you living for your family, your nation, the suffering Iraqis, or who? Until you have a beneficiary, there's just a floating somebody's life. So these three questions, there's a reason why these three are by themselves as the foundation. And that's what I call the good. And then chapter 8 is the detailed chewing of, well, what does rationality consist of, and what lesser or intermediate value should you go after if you were to achieve your ultimate goal. And then chapter 9 is the final reward of it all. But those are all later questions. So that once you know the answer to these three, you don't know everything, but you know everything basic. You know the essence of the way of life that you're after. Now, within this, to establish these three points, the first two sequences are concerned with establishing the end, the ultimate goal. And the first one deals with the relation between the concept of life and the concept of value, and takes us to the point that life must be the ultimate goal, must be the standard of all value codes. Wherever there's values on the part of anything, and of course any living organism, life has to be the standard. So that's not yet brought down to human life or human beings. It's simply the essential relationship between life and value. Now, the only real thing that I have that's at all new here, which I think is pretty good, is on page 297, the tie-in between, this is paragraph 3, the tie-in between metaphysics and ethics here, that there's only one metaphysical fundamental, existence. and that the issue of life or death is just the application of that fundamental to ethics, that the alternative of existence or non-existence is the precondition of all values. And this is elaborated quite well, I think, on 298, I'm skipping, but 1, 2, 3, oh, let's go from the bottom, 1, 2, 3, 4 from the bottom, where it says only self-preservation can be an ultimate goal, only self-preservation. No other imaginable or conceivable goal could be an ultimate goal, could be the final thing that you're after, the standard, because it has a unique nature. And that was my best point, I think, that the essence of self-preservation is accepting reality, saying I'm going to stay in reality and do what's required as against, leave it. And then I show that, you've read this, that in every branch of philosophy, existence has to be a primary. And what's the simple reason for that? There is nothing else. There's the General Motors competes with Ford, but there's nothing competing with existence. There is no alternative realm. So if you're in metaphysics, you can't say, where did existence come from? What's its cause? There is no other. In epistemology, you can't talk about a reason which transcends existence, which is neutral, as between existence and non-existence, because then it would be a delusory faculty. It wouldn't bother to make such prejudicial distinctions, you know, as true versus false or real versus unreal. And the same thing applies in regard to value judgments. You cannot say, why should I stay in reality? Why should I take this realm? Because the implication of such a question is there is some alternative to it, and you can jump out of it and say, now the advantages of reality are A, B, and C, whereas the unreality has on its side only D, so therefore I'm going to... There is no such choice, you see. So if you keep in mind actually existence exists, then the choice to live, I would say, is simply the affirmation of existence. It's the acknowledgement, this is it, this is all there is, and I accept it. I'm not looking for another dimension. And this is why I think self-preservation is unique as an ultimate goal. It's the only metaphysical goal. It's the goal whose nature consists of embracing reality. And that's why, if you were guaranteed existence, you were this immortal robot, there would be nothing you could value because you're guaranteed to stay in existence, or at least there's nothing you can do to affect the outcome one way or the other. And when that choice is outside of your domain, then there's no possibility of selecting values of better or worse, etc. All right, now we move to the second section. If life has to be the ultimate goal of any set of values, we now come to the species that interests us, the human species. And this is the first time that we can introduce human beings and human life as the standard. Is human life the standard of value as such anywhere? Obviously not. Human life is not the standard of value to a carrot, which has its own interests, or I wouldn't say interest because it's not conscious, but its own form of action and its own goal-directed behavior. But human life is the standard for not of value, but of moral value. And moral value in this context means values applicable to a being with choice, values who has to choose, that have to be chosen by the acting entity. Now, so you see the subtitle is here, it's man's life as the standard of moral value, because not all the values that exist in the universe are moral values. They have to be chosen values. For instance, air is a value, and it's something your body acts to gain and keep at all times, but it's not a moral value because you do it automatically. You cannot volitionally stop doing it or start doing it. You can't even hold your breath till you die. Now, you can suffocate yourself, but let's not get into the death of famous writers. Now, in this sequence about man's life as a standard of value, I do have, I think, some important points that have not been stressed in the literature, and that starts on the bottom of page 300, the very last sentence. And I have, for your edification, put on the board the word long range. Now, it's been standard objectivism for a long time that man has to discover the right moral values, that he's born ignorant and he has to learn what's right and wrong, and his life depends on him choosing the right one. Now, what I do, starting on that last sentence on page 300, is chew this standard point, develop or elaborate it in a new way. It's the same point. But what I'm trying to do is define what kind of knowledge would help us in the act of living. How do we know when we have or have not discovered the moral knowledge that we need? Now, obviously, it's true that we don't know how to act and we have to discover it. But what would be the test that we have discovered the knowledge that life requires? What are the problems that we face in living, in the broadest terms? And what must an item of knowledge do in order to answer these problems? How do we know when we have the answer or we don't? And that's what I was trying to answer. And to show you why, step by step, you have to have something called a principle, which has to have certain attributes and has to be reached a certain way in order to solve certain problems. And that is like a detailed chewing of the abstract proposition that man needs to discover the right moral values. Otherwise, if you simply say to somebody, well, you need to discover, you know, the right values, you know, you need ethics to guide your choices, you'll hear the most incredible diversity of people who will agree with you and say, oh, absolutely, you couldn't live without the guidance of, you know, moral principles. But for instance, an ecologist will say, I know what the crucial principle we need for our guidance. All species are interrelated, and we live on this fragile planet with its fragile ecology. So basically, what we have to do is have egalitarianism for all species, with the human on the lowest rung. And that's the best way to sustain life. Now, leaving aside, you know, whether his facts are true, whether our ecology is so fragile and so on, what is wrong with that as a kind of answer? That's what we have to find out. There's an epistemological error in that as an answer, far over and above whether the facts of ecology are true or false. Of course, they're all ridiculous lies made up out of whole cloth, but it wouldn't make any difference if it was true. That would not be a satisfactory moral answer. Or if somebody said, for instance, yes, certainly we need moral guidance, we need the knowledge that you should live for your neighbor and that you're your brother's keeper. Now that is morality, it's guidance, but it's certainly not satisfactory. Why not? Over and above the fact that it's bad advice. I mean, what is wrong? What is in common between that and the ecological answer? Or I'll give you one more answer. A person who says, well, yes, I know what you should do. I agree that we need moral guidance, and what you need for moral guidance is don't take arsenic, don't tell lies, try and get a job, honor your mother, oh yes, cyanide, don't take a lot of that, don't smoke for more than 5 years. And, you know, you go on page after page after page after page, and you could even agree with it. That is still not a solution and would not function to support human life. Now, my point is that all of those three examples, the ecologist, the Christian, and this last guy with his lists, the concrete bound type, are the same from the point of view of the objectivist perspective. And what is the same about them is that they all miss why morality is needed to begin with. And that's what I'm trying to develop in this section that starts on the bottom of page 300. And what I do is say, step by step, what is the problem that morality is supposed to be an answer to? Now, I'm not going to recapitulate all the details because I think it's clear in the book, but I start with the fact that man has to act long range. Otherwise, he's out of control. He's just like a short-range whim worshiper. He doesn't have any idea where his actions are leading, and he's necessarily going to be inconsistent and ultimately self-destructive. And then, but why should he be consistent? Why can't, so long as you know he eats and sleeps and so on, what difference does it make whether he's inconsistent part of the time? And that leads to the next point that I explain, why life, the actions that it requires have to be all-embracing. There's no aspect of your behavior that is exempt from consequences that ultimately redound on the well-being, the vitality, the ability to live of the total organism. And that then raises the question, we have to act long range, we have to take into account the consequences of everything we do, because everything has consequences. And that raises the question, well, how far into the future do we have to be? How long do we have to look in being long range? And then, as you know, of course, I argue, it's not enough to be a week or a month or whichever. You have to know the consequences across your whole lifespan, and that's an essential difference, as Ayn Rand points out, between man and the animals. So this, in sum, and I think it's very well put, if I say so myself, the last paragraph of 302 is the problem to which ethics is the solution. And the problem is, the last paragraph of 302, man must be long range. He must know the survival significance of every action he takes. And he has to know it in relation to the time span of an entire human life. Now, what could make such an incredible cognitive feat possible? How could you possibly know at any given point the consequences into the indefinite future of everything from every aspect? How could you simply hold that much information? And you see now, if you had read the earlier chapters, when you set up the thing that way, the answer is implicit in the problem. I'm thinking of chapters 3 and 4, which deal with concepts and concept formation and unit economy and so on, and it's obvious that the only way to hold this much data, this many data, is by what? Condensation, compression, unit economy. There's no other way to do it, and that means, in other words, you have to conceptualize the requirements of human survival. But now, by conceptualize, I don't mean just utter words, because you haven't read the earlier chapters, or some of you haven't, but there are many principles involved in how you must conceptualize, which I discussed earlier. You have to know what are the fundamentals in a given field, because you're trying to economize units. And the only way you can do it, you can't have 100 things in mind. You take certain fundamentals, and they imply all the consequences, and you only have to retain the fundamentals, and that way you cover the whole field. Whereas if you just take some one superficial or derivative point, it doesn't lead you anywhere or entail all the rest, so you don't have all the rest of that data implicit in your mind. And that basically is what is wrong with the ecological answer. If you look at paragraph 1, 2, 3, 4 on 303, where this first sentence is that we have to take the array of human choices and actions in all its bewildering complexity, and it's tremendously complex and bewildering just if you look at it raw. And that's why most people say, who can say what's right? Your opinion is not my opinion, and there's 1,000 factors, and who knows what's relevant and what isn't. The only way out of that is to condense it down to the level like a percept by unity economy, and that means, first, I list the things in order. What are the fundamental choices? Ethics has to pertain only to the fundamental choices. You want to? Ethics has to concern itself only with the fundamental choices, because you can only hold so much, and they are the ones that contain all the other choices. And therefore, you do not ask in ethics such questions as, how much should I tip a cab driver, or even, should I be Should I be kind to my employees? Those are already far down applications. You're trying to go to the root of the choices that underlie all other human behavior. And therefore, that ecology thing, even if it were true that our species are all interdependent and so on, we'd still have to say, what are the fundamental choices that we have in dealing with this and every other type of question? You couldn't just jump in arbitrarily with some derivative and say, this is an important principle, this is our ethical guidance. Before it qualifies as ethics, if unit economy is our goal, you have to go all the way back to the fundamentals. And that's why, if you notice the objectivist ethics, the primary choice, which is the issue of free will, is to think or not to think. And therefore, ethics primarily has to govern how you exercise this choice. And therefore, the primary virtue is the mandate, exercise it. That's rationality, think. And then all the other virtues consist of telling us, what does it mean to think in relation to people? What does it mean to think in relation to work, etc., and so on? So in that sense, you cannot get more fundamental if our theory of volition is correct, because that is the only root choice that we have. Now, but it's not enough to be fundamental. I go on to the next sentence there. What abstractions integrate all the instances of such choices from the aspect of their relationship to self-preservation? Our standard is life, self-preservation. Therefore, even though you could say self-sacrifice is certainly a fundamental, it's not a superficial thing like this ecological construct, it is directly contrary to the requirements of life, of self-preservation. It tells you give up, renounce, rather than deny, rather than live and achieve your welfare. So it's out on the grounds of a warped standard. And even so, there's still one other thing. We have to have a fundamental that isn't required by the nature of life. But I go on the last sentence. What generalizations identify in condensed, retainable form the pro or anti-life effects of given choices? If it's not condensed and retainable, it's no use to us. The whole purpose is unit reduction. If it's a list of commandments, it's invalid on that ground. Even if every commandment came out of Atlas Shrugged. Thou shalt be just, and thou shalt pay thy debts, and thou, I could give you 50 that an objectivist would agree with, but it would be of no use, it would be of no guidance, and you would end up just as though you had no guidance at all, practically speaking. That's wrong with this guy who said don't eat poison, so on. In all these cases, from different aspects, they don't grasp that the purpose of ethics is unit reduction, to give an answer to this question from the aspect of what's required to survive. And therefore, their attempts at ethics are abortive, floating, out of context, concrete-bound, useless. And that, I think, will help to see why ethics is crucial. There's really two questions here. Why do we need any ethical guidance at all? And then what could such guidance consist of? And the answers to the questions are, we need guidance because we need an incredible amount of knowledge of a specific kind. And we can get that knowledge only in a super condensed form. And of course, the name for a conceptual statement of a fundamental generalization is principle. And that's why we have to have moral principles. And that tells us in advance when something is a moral principle and when it isn't, and how to find them. Now you see, by this approach, you couldn't dream of having a moral practical dichotomy. It's wiped out at the very inception, because ethics is only the knowledge you need in order to be practical. I mean, assuming life is your goal and you mean by practicality the things required to achieve it. So that's why it wouldn't occur to Ayn Rand that there could be such a dichotomy, and why she spent a lot of time in her thinking trying to figure out where did people get this from, because the whole thing was so alien to her approach that she tried to penetrate. Where did it come from? It just seemed a complete aberration. And you see why. If you start ethics from this point of view, you just couldn't imagine such a dichotomy. Now that takes us through really the base of the base. That is, man's life as the standard of moral value. Now then there's one section on rationality and one on egoism. And I think the only point that I want to make in advance here is a hierarchical point. Why do I cover rationality before egoism rather than after? Structurally. You obviously have to start with life. But why couldn't you go life and then egoism and then rationality? Since all these three questions are so interconnected anyway, why did I cover rationality first? And my answer to that would be, if you don't put the primary virtue in immediately, the second you get the words life out of your mouth and proved, I mean, then the issue of life or man's life has no meaning. You can't ask who gets the good until you know what the good is. And life is a process. What process? Well, you say the process of self-sustaining action. Well, what is that process in the case of human beings? What is self-sustaining action? Is it rolling in the aisles, praying, or what? I mean, is it just sitting and eating until you explode? No, you say, well, man's faculty of self-sustenance is reason. So inherent in life is, for man, is life by the guidance of reason. Now, suppose, and then you can say whose life, and it's just a corollary. It has to be the life of the actor. But suppose you went in the opposite direction. You started with life as the standard, and you say, now, I haven't a clue how life is achieved, but I first want to know whose life. Well, how are you going to decide? Someone says, or the thought occurs to you, I think the best way would be to start slaughtering people. You know, I'll sacrifice others to myself. That'll promote my life. But then others feel the same way. And then you have mutual killing. So another person observes that and he says, oh, well, you see, your mistake was that the real beneficiary should not be you as a single individual. It should be the group as a whole. Now, this obviously is not fantasy. This is the history of Western civilization. There's no way you can untangle all that, except if you say to people, or to yourself in your structure of your thinking, before we say who gets it, how, what kind of process are we talking about? How is life actually achieved? And once you establish it's achieved by a process of thought and consequent action, that it requires rationality, then it's very simple to see. Each person has to live independently in all the various virtues, and each one has to be the beneficiary of his own action. So, I grant you this much. It's a close call. It's the closest call in the whole book of the order here. Because these three questions are so interconnected, I feel that even if you got life and rationality out and then you died, without getting egoism in, the first two would not be clear. But given the choice, the scale was tipped for me in favor of rationality as being essential to grasping egoism. And you'll see when we get into egoism, or you probably see that already, it presupposes to be understood the virtue of rationality. If you didn't have that, you couldn't even make clear what you meant by egoism, except in such abstract terms that it would be compatible with any course of behavior. All right, now the only last preliminary is I want to just call your attention to the last sequence, which is not in itself ethical, and that is it doesn't offer guidance, but it simply identifies the status of values in Ayn Rand's philosophy, and that is the values as objective on page 320. Now, I'm counting here on the fact that you know the importance of this topic as it's discussed in chapter 4, of concepts as objective rather than intrinsic or subjective, which has been covered exhaustively earlier in the book. And of course, this is the concept from which Ayn Rand named her philosophy. So by the time you get to this here in chapter 7, it becomes hopefully an obvious application of what you already thoroughly understand. Now this, I think philosophically, is the most important sequence because it ties the objectivist ethics to the objectivist theory of concept formation. And since that's the essence of the epistemology, this is really the topic or the sequence that unites the whole philosophy. This is the master central link connecting the epistemology to the ethics and politics. And the key passage is, which I think is well done, is the top three paragraphs of 321, which I call to your attention. That's really the pivot which takes you from epistemology to ethics and politics. And the key there is a value for objectivism means evaluation. It's not a floating Platonic packet of something or other, and it's not a subjective emotional state. It's an evaluation based on certain facts. And an evaluation is, animals do not evaluate. They have values, they pursue things, but they don't say, a bone is great, you know, or my master is wicked. They can't evaluate. They can't form value judgment. An evaluation is a type of concept, a type of abstraction. It's just a subdivision within the field of concepts. And therefore, whatever status concepts have, values have to have. They have to have the same rules, the same method of treatment, the same form of discovery, the same form of validation. Everything that's true of concepts as such has to be true of values, because values are simply a subdivision within the field of concepts. And this is the central reason why the theory of concepts always dictates a philosopher's ethics, whether he admits it or not, which in turn, of course, dictates his politics and so on. So it all goes back to a theory of concepts. And here is the link right here. And the best formulation is, of course, Ayn Rand's on the very top of 321. She says there, the good is an aspect of reality in relation to man. That's the objective, as against the intrinsic, which is that the good is just a free-floating entity apart from any evaluation, apart from any beneficiary, or from the subjectivist, who says that value or the good is simply a name for whatever I or society happens to feel without reference to facts. And she says, no, it's reality in relation to man. And then I work that formulation out for concepts and values in paragraph 3. Concepts designate facts. What facts? Well, the objects we perceive, and specifically their similarities and differences. But it's not just fact, because animals perceive facts. It's facts with a definite relation to man, in this case to human consciousness. And what is the relationship? We condense them, we integrate them in this distinctive way which leads to concepts, and we have to do it by a definite method, which is logic. Well, now the good is exactly the same thing, you see. It's facts, in this case, not all facts, but a specific kind of facts, the requirements of survival, as identified conceptually, in other words, in relation to our form of cognition, and then evaluated in accordance with a certain standard of value, which also has to be rational, and that's life. So therefore, moral knowledge is just like conceptual knowledge. And this is the basic answer to anybody who tries to say there's such a thing as a conscience or a moral intuition or revelation of right and wrong. Morality is just a type of truth. It's a field grasped and consisting of concepts. And it is no different from any other scientific subject. So you see what I'm referring to here. If you want to discover moral truth, you can't rely either on passive perception of the external. Who am I referring to in passive perception of the external? That's the intrinsicist who waits for God's revelation to strike him. Or you can't rely on mental events divorced from the external. Who is that? That's a subjectivist who just consults his or other people's emotional or other inner processes apart from reality. Instead, we have to actively process perceptual data, etc. Now, this would be, I think, more meaningful to you if you had chapters 3 and 4 and compared the formulation, and you would see that the same wording that describes concepts describes moral conclusions, and then it'll tie the whole thing together for you. So I'm sorry that you have to read the book as like coming into a movie in the middle. But the thing is, you have had a lot of it one way or the other. All right, let's go back now with the understanding that you don't have to be relevant. Oh, I got the wrong chapter here. And take it one section at a time. And if there's anything I wanted to say on the let's take the first two sections together. Oh, I just wanted to call your attention to on page 300 to a line that I liked. That's four paragraphs from the bottom. Page 300. Morality is the instruction manual in regard to proper care and use that did not come with man. I like that, I must say. And I was having lunch one day, right when I was writing this, and an instruction manual, I think for a TV set, had come. And it just suddenly connected, that's what I'm doing, you know, only it's... So... I just wanted to point out to you on page 303, I give you the important things and then I give you the little tidbits. On the bottom of 303, or the third last paragraph, it struck me what a horrible view people have of morality, that it was necessary to clarify that when you act on moral principle, you're not a martyr, a zealot, or a prig. Because everybody assumes automatically that you have to be a martyr. Why? Because the moral isn't practical, so you're going to have to destroy yourself. A zealot, why? Because who can know anything, and therefore you've got to be a dogmatist going on some kind of blind faith, or a prig, why? Well, no, but you can't be interested in pleasure, that's the opposite of morality. So as soon as people hear moral principle, they think of a blind, suffering self-sacrificer. And I mean, it's a commentary, you know. I mean, if the civilization survives and anybody were to read a sentence like this 2,000 or 3,000 years from now, there would probably be people in the class asking, why would he make a statement? You know, why would that be necessary? It would be like saying to us, a man who acts on moral principle is neither overweight nor, addicted to cocaine. You say, well... Why would you think of that? But it shows the state we're in that you have to make those kind of clarifications. And one last clarification here on 304. I know I gave you a lecture on asking questions and now I'm using up all the time. But the second paragraph, this was the point that was clarifying to me. I always thought that the reason man needs ethics is because he has free will, period. And that no more is required as to why man needs ethics, but that he's got choice, and therefore he has to have some guidance. And I asked Ms. Rand about that once. She said, certainly not. Why would you need ethics just because you have free will? And I said, well, because you don't know what to do. She said, well, why should you know what to do? And I said, well, what do you mean? How could you choose what's right or wrong? She said, well, what difference does it make? And I was completely stopped, you know. She said, just go out and do whatever you feel like. So, you know, after a while, she explained the point that free will is a necessity, it's a necessary condition of morality, but not sufficient. It's because we're confronted with the choice of life or death, and we have to act by choice, that we need guidance. Both of those are essential, but simply that man has free will does not necessitate ethics. Because it doesn't give us any goal. It doesn't mandate any course of behavior. It's wide open. And that's another reason why In Christianity, the belief in free will has nothing to do with their ethics. Ethics is just commandments, and then free will is, you know, a little thing you do on the side. Okay, I'm going to finally give you a chance to...
You said that an entire lifespan is the frame of reference, or the long-range frame of reference for ethical judgment. Could it also be longer than that, such as the life of your children or the people you value? Or
Should I repeat that? Yeah. Could or should the consideration be not just your lifespan, but the lifespan of those you value, like your children? I would say up to a point, if no sacrifice is involved and those you value, you do so rationally with a provable connection to your life. Now, for instance, if it's your child, you still can't consider the consequences of your action. Now, I happen to be over half a century older than my daughter. Now, I obviously cannot, even with the conceptual faculty, I can't add another 50 years of foresight. You know, I have enough work, you know, keeping up with my own lifespan. But within the limits of the possible, I would want to do what was rational for me. You know, see that her education is provided for, she's financially taken care of so far as I could, and educated, etc. But at a certain point, she's an adult. She's outside of my control, whether I was around or not. So I would become a self-sacrificer, you know, if I said, well, in order to be sure that my daughter at age 30 is living in the kind of lifestyle that I want her to have, I will forego a trip to Hawaii this year. I would regard that as flatly irrational. I mean, that would be self-sacrificing. And it's even worse if you say, we should all on earth now sacrifice, because after all, the continuation of the human race is important. We have to take into account posterity. I'll give you what I consider as a completely vicious argument. This argument that, what was it, Yellowstone, that they let burn out of control, on the grounds that for 100 or 200 years, it's just going to be charred ruins. Everybody now alive will be entirely deprived of the value of this park that all of their taxes go to maintain. But that's okay, the ecologist said, because 200 years from now it'll start growing again, you know, and then posterity will enjoy it. Now, that to me is, you know, when I hear that, my reaction is to say, you should go until the day you die and stop. You should have no consideration. You should take the attitude of that poem, the world ends when I die, and I have no concern beyond that day, with only the exception if it's a provable rational value and you're not sacrificing, you can extend it that way. Okay. You're asking Diane, not me.
I've often wondered why Ms. Rand chose the word to act in the definition of values of what one acts to gain or keep rather than what one desires or wishes. It seems like an action.
Good question. Excellent question.
To a decision.
I'll answer your question. In the first draft of Galt's speech, which I happen to know, she defined it as that which one seeks to gain or keep. And then she consciously changed it to that which one acts to gain or keep and or keep. And she explained it this way. First of all, it has to be broad enough to encompass all living organisms, including those which have no faculty of desire or wishing, etc. A plant acts to gain and or keep certain things, but doesn't seek them, desire them, wish for them, etc. Secondly, she said, the word seek, and certainly the word wish or hope or whatever, would be a fantastic loophole for the sort of person who says, I really want to be an actor. That's my life ambition. I wish it, so it's my value, but never does anything. You know, never auditions and never reads a play and never takes an acting class and just sits around saying, oh, my highest value is to be an actor. Now, if you said a value is that which one wishes to gain, he certainly wishes, but Ayn Rand would say that is not one of his values. Because he has the opportunity to act, but he doesn't act. and a value she wanted to cut out, in effect, yearning detached from reality. And therefore, that was the other reason why she changed it to, if you're not doing something, it is not a value. Now, you have to take that in context. Obviously, there are things which are values, even though you don't act on them, because at that moment in time, you don't have the money, you don't have the time, or you don't have the freedom, or whatever. So we're taking account that all value and evaluation is in a context, but assuming that, if you have the capacity to act for something, and you don't, then it's not a value of yours. And this can give you a good insight into yourself, particularly when you get to a certain age. Because at a certain point in your life, you will say, if you're like most people or like me, well, I'm X, and I always wanted to do so-and-so. And then it'll occur to you, well, so-and-so takes a fair amount of time. So if you want to do it, either now or that's it. Abandon it and don't say that's a value. And there are many things that I started to do fairly recently, precisely on the grounds that a value is that which one acts to gain and keep. And other things I said, I guess that's not a value because given the choices, I'm never going to do it. So I just dropped the idea that that was a value, although I had thought it was up to that point. But it was one of those someday, you know, only someday came and it was still not now, so I said goodbye. Okay, yeah.
Is that John?
Yeah. Leonard?
Yeah.
Could you explain on page 299, in the middle in italics, why you wrote, any code of values must hold life as the ultimate value, rather than writing, any rational code of values must hold life?
Oh, yeah, because why do I say any code of values must hold life as the ultimate value rather than any rational code of values? Because a rational code of values could be misunderstood here. You're trying to make the point that people hold values that, in fact, don't hold life as the ultimate value. Well, the truth is they do and they don't. By the fact of holding values, they can't escape ascribing some primary value to life, but what they do is contradict it. But if I were to say a rational code, that would beg the question. The question would be, what is a rational code? Is it a code reached by a process of reason? Then that wouldn't apply to plants and animals, because they don't reach it by a process of reason. Is it a code that's provably valid? Well, there's a question. How can you say that the code of a carrot is valid or invalid? It's like a sense perception is neither true or false. It is, you see. So I would introduce such a kettle of fish if I put that word in. I have to rely on the context here. If you're going to go by what value literally means and depends on, that's what I start the sentence, by the very nature of value, therefore, then life has to be the ultimate. Now, of course, that people can accept values and contradict the nature of value, that's on their head. But you see why I didn't want to restrict it. Well, that's a really good question.
Following up on that, once you say the ultimate end is life,
yeah,
which is itself a self-sustaining process, is it necessary to say egoism is the, where the beneficiary of actions is oneself?
Yeah, once you say life is the ultimate goal and life is self-sustaining action, why make a point about egoism? Isn't that already there? That is exactly the same question as, once you say A is A, what's the point of saying don't contradict yourself? I mean, it's the same thing, right? Only it made a big difference when Aristotle came along and said the obvious. One is a corollary of the other. And a corollary means a self-evident implication from a specific aspect. You see, so it's like I say, life is self-sustaining action. There is virtually no one who would disagree with that. But if I then come in and say, you know, according to us, it's self-sustaining action. They say, oh no, that's selfish. You see, so the whole thing is, it's, you're right that it doesn't have a new content, and yet how many people would say, oh, life is the goal, is wonderful, but you mustn't be egoistic, that's terrible. You know, so you have to spell it out. It is implicit, certainly. All right, let's, I just realized we've got to get a couple more sections in here. Let's look quickly at rationality. On page 308, there's just an important point there that I want to bring out. Now, the top sentence that everything in reality is interconnected is discussed earlier in the book. That's a metaphysical point that Ayn Rand, I think, elaborated only in conversation, but I gave her discussion of it in the book, and about why you couldn't take any one fact and obliterate it without obliterating the total universe, leaving aside volitional choices. But the thing I want to bring out to your attention here is the second paragraph. Just as every idea has a relationship to one's other ideas, and none can be accepted until it is seen to be an element of a single cognitive whole, that's the issue that you have to integrate. You have to make it total. So every fact has a relationship to other facts, and none can be evaded without tearing apart and destroying, invalidating your knowledge. And the point I'm trying to make here is that evasion, which is the essential objectivist vice, is the exact antithesis of integration, which is the heart of the objectivist epistemology. The essence of the epistemology says unite, and the essence of evasion is splinter, disintegrate. Willfully refuse to see the connection between A and B. And from that point of view, you could do a terrific book, somebody could do, not me, on ethics as nothing but epistemology and practice. Because the whole objective of ethics is how to use your mind, and the subject which deals with that is epistemology. So you could take every one of the virtues as an application of epistemology. That is not my own thought. That was Ayn Rand's point, but I couldn't find a way to do it briefly, so I couldn't, but it's contained in here. And you see, this is where the issue of the arbitrary comes in. The arbitrary, asserting the arbitrary, is exactly the same fallacy as evasion. It's the same thing. It's disconnecting something from any context, from all the rest of the material. It's disintegrating, just saying, your soul is going to live on after you die. How do you know? I don't know. Prove that it isn't so. Well, what's that based on? Nothing. Prove that it isn't so. Well, how does it relate to what we know about living things? Forget that. Prove that it isn't so. Now, there's this just disintegrated claim to which nothing connects. That's exactly what an evader does. He doesn't want to see something, so he just tears it out and throws it away and looks at the rest without connection. So it's two forms of violating the mandate of integration. And I just thought I'd point that out to you here. Oh yes, on 311, there's a formulation that is not entirely exact, but it's too late to do anything about it. I'm sure I'll keep following these, finding these till I die, but on paragraph 3 on 311, see, about halfway through, we're talking about if you have a clash between emotions and ideas. And I say, if some emergency requires an immediate decision, then the person in conflict has to act without full knowledge. Well, that actually unduly restricts the circumstances in which you have to act without full knowledge, because it occurred to me, after this went to press, unfortunately, that I have this situation in lecturing all the time. I can't decide, I don't know whether to give a certain example or not, which just occurred to me. And I see, it's not an emergency, I mean, no one, life depends on it, but I can't stop the class and go out and put down, there are three reasons to give it and two reasons against. So I just have to go like that with the best guess I have at the moment. And that would be an example of, I'm in conflict and I'm acting without full self-knowledge. I don't know, I haven't resolved the reasons prompting me, but I'm, you know, for and against, but I'm in action midstream, and I just have to go with what comes. This is particularly true if you're on TV, for instance, and you're in the midst of a debate. See, with a class, you can sort of think aloud, and you can get some leeway by saying, "What do you think, Mr. Stubblefield?" And while he's groping, you know, you get a clue to where you're going. But if you're on TV, and somebody says something, and three different answers occur to you, you know that if you take 1 second to try to decide, you're lost. The next person will start to speak, and then you'll never get in. So you just, it's like Bearden's ass, you just grab whichever one your tongue goes to. It absolutely makes no difference, and you just talk. And after the show, you'll often think, "Oh, I really should have taken this one," but it's a situation like this. You have to decide instantaneously. So the word emergency there is a little overwrought, but I mean, the idea is true, but it's broader than... Now, let's just take a quick look at... there was any little points in egoism. I think perhaps from the point of view of the validation of egoism, the bottom paragraph of 313 is a good point, that you can't separate the process of cognition and its beneficiary. I won't bother reading it, but I think that, and also the top paragraph of 314, I like that. You know, a brain like a factory, you'll notice on 316, paragraph 4, I allow myself an emotional adjective. Now, usually, I try to keep this pretty dry, on the grounds that it's really more in the nature of a textbook, not a call from the barricade. But every once in a while, I couldn't restrain myself, and here I consider I had proved it. So I had no problem with writing the vicious act of sacrifice. Which was very satisfying, because I've only done that about, I think, 8 times in 500 pages, you know, where I say outright that somebody is a swine. Okay, let's take anything on those sections now. Now you're trying to spread this around, right? Yeah.
I've been thinking about why it would not be egoistic to sacrifice others to myself.
Yeah.
And I arrived at 2 reasons. My question regards whether these are the main reasons, and if so, which is the most fundamental. My first reason was that in basing my survival on the actions or sacrifices of others, I would become dependent on those others. My second reason was that by forcing those others, I would, in principle, forfeit the benefits of knowledge and trade, both of which are to be found in greatest abundance in a society where men are left free.
Well, I mean, I agree with those two, but I could give you 8 reasons more. Oh, sorry. I don't want to go into the long story, but he wants to know, what is the validation of the claim that it is not to your self-interest to sacrifice others to yourself? And he said to me, which of 2 reasons is it? And I don't remember your exact wording, but the idea was, if you sacrifice others to yourself, you'll probably be using force, and a society that uses force will not produce as much knowledge and wealth as one where men are free. And the other reason was you become dependent on others, so you violate the virtue of independence. Which of those 2 is the right answer? And my answer is both and neither. Because I can think of 8 other reasons. If you're going to give a reason on that level, why you shouldn't sacrifice others to yourself. To every virtue that you recognize in the objectivist code, there is a reason why you shouldn't sacrifice others to yourself, because you'll make that virtue impossible also. And if you go through the virtues one after the other, for instance, you can't be just, you can't accept the virtue of justice, you have to throw that out if your idea is you don't care whether you deserve or don't deserve, whether it's earned or unearned. You want it, you're going to take it. Obviously, you have to throw out rationality then, because you're going just because you want it. Doesn't make any difference what anybody says. And if I tell you, well, here's an argument, you say, what do I care about arguments or principles? I want it. So integrity has to be, out the window. Well, with that kind of mental apparatus, are you going to be able to produce? When you say, I don't have to produce, I get it from the people that I sacrifice. You know, so you have to have a double standard. You have to turn yourself into on every count. And then what is going to be your self-esteem? Well, it's going to be a function of your ability to deal with reality. You've thrown out your mind, you have no principles, you're at the mercy of others, you can't produce the means of your own survival. You know, so obviously you're going to be quaking in anxiety. Every single virtue you have to throw out. And because the real reason, which is neither of the ones you mentioned, because they're all of that is true. Everything that's anti-life will follow from that, but why? What is the real, ultimate, primary validation of the idea that you shouldn't sacrifice others to self? Well, you see if you can think about it. Think what it could be. It's, well, no, I haven't finished the question. That's rhetorical. Well, I'll give you this much of a hint. It goes back to the definition of life and the necessity to think in principle. Now, you're asking for a moral question, right? What was morality for? Which we discussed already. We need fundamental principles, right? So as soon as you're raising the question, why should I live this way rather than that way? You've got to think in terms of fundamental principles, because that's all that morality consists of, right? And what is the fundamental principle that's relevant to the life of a living organism, of any species? No, not all living organisms are long range. What is the, not the definition, but the philosophic description? Self-sustaining, self-generated action. Now, that idea of independence is implicit in that. When you validate egoism, as this gentleman showed, all you do is stress the self. But the very nature of your argument necessarily applies to anyone in the same category. Because you didn't bring your name into it. There was nothing about you. You were saying from the nature of a living organism that survives by reason, he has to pursue his own survival. Well, that principle, if you're thinking in terms of fundamental principles, has to apply to any other living organism which also uses its mind. It would apply to a Martian which uses its mind. You could not sacrifice him or he you, even if you know, his body was completely different from yours. So long as he was open to reason, the same argument would apply, and the moment you sacrifice him to you, you would be abandoning principle, abandoning reason, and wiping out the whole code, and therefore, if that's the code of life, destroying yourself in the process. The only time that it would not apply is to a living species that didn't have the faculty of reason. Because then you can't communicate, you can't argue, there's no way, you know, if they come charging at you to say, let's sit down and discuss it. So that it has to be dog eat dog. So that is the absurdity of the animal rights movement, that deny rights to human beings and award them to animals, you know, which is the absolute inversion of the truth. But to get back to this, I think the more clarifying point for you would be to remember that when you ask for a moral validation by using the word moral, you have already committed yourself to two terms, fundamental and principle. And if you think in those terms, you won't worry about, well, what does it do to my sex life, or what does it do to the amount of, to the economy, and so on. You know, you go right back to the root. Okay.
What is the difference between a normative subject and an evaluative one? Because epistemology is not an evaluative subject, but I understand that it is a normative.
Well, that's a really good question. What is the difference between a normative and an evaluative subject? Well, I don't know that I can give you a formal definition as I use the term. One could argue, to be perfectly fair, that epistemology is not normative, that it simply describes the processes that are required if you're to reach the product which is knowledge. And in that sense, it's simply a means to an end, or a cause to an effect. You see what I mean? And that epistemology doesn't say, you should do this. It says, if you want a certain goal, then you should. On the other hand, so you see, from that point of view, you could say epistemology is just factual. It doesn't give value to it. But I regard that as not really plausible, because you could do the same thing with ethics. You could say, ethics doesn't say, thou shalt live. In fact, Ayn Rand has a whole article, you know, causality versus duty, where she says, if you choose to live, then etc. and so on, you have to follow these virtues. So it's exactly parallel to epistemology. And in that way, they both offer the broadest term for which I call normative. They both set standards to guide some course of human behavior. Now, the difference is that ethics describes behavior involving the total human being in all of his choices and actions, whereas epistemology is much more specialized. It's the proper use of one specific faculty, vital to be sure, but it doesn't have the universality that ethics does. I don't know if that's a satisfactory answer, but that's about the best I can. There is a sense in which epistemology is factual and ethics is evaluative, but to me, they both are alike, as in contrast to metaphysics, for instance. From that point of view, I regard them as both alike. Even though epistemology is not evaluative in the sense of saying, you know, reason is good and mysticism is bad. It's not an evaluative, it's just factual. But it definitely gives guidance as against metaphysics. Now, metaphysics doesn't say you should obey the law of cause and effect. As far as metaphysics is concerned, you can do anything you want, and the cause and effect are still going to go on. If you jump out the window, you'll fall, that's all. So metaphysics just says there is a world. You don't like it? Good luck. But there's no advice. You know, you could read a treatise on metaphysics till you died and have no clue as to what to do. I mean, it's a precondition of all advice, but it's different from epistemology, you see. That's why, according to objectivism, metaphysics is very brief. You know, the whole thing is one chapter if you stretch it out. Whereas epistemology goes on chapter after chapter or volume after volume because of the difference. And in that sense, the epistemology and ethics are more like each other than either is to metaphysics.
Both of them are based on the fact that we have volition.
Yes, that's right. All of philosophy except for metaphysics is based on the fact of volition. That was why I decided to put volition at the very beginning. As soon as I got reality into the picture, well, I needed one thing before volition. You had to perceive, because otherwise, you know, you couldn't even get into know that there was anything around. But that's given you automatically. And then right away we went to volition as the precondition of everything else. Epistemology, ethics, politics, aesthetics. So, from my perspective, a deterministic philosophy is an actual self-contradiction. All right, let me just take a look here at the last section, if there was any little point I wanted to make. Oh, I like that phrase, the bad name which the good now has, which is true on 323. Oh, I did want to point out to you 324, the bottom. All these people that are going to say, well, if the choice to live is a primary, you know, you just have to accept existence, isn't that arbitrary? And the person who chooses suicide is just as good as you, and therefore ethics is all subjective. That's a standard one. And I think this is a very well written answer, that paragraph that starts on the bottom of 324. A primary choice does not mean a groundless choice. Now, on the face of it, that's paradoxical, because if it's primary, it's the beginning. And yet, if it's not groundless, there must be grounds for it. So something which precedes it. And so that's exactly what all these people say. Well, if it's primary, it has to be groundless. And I am saying, not if you understand the nature of the grounds. Because the grounds here is no more nor less than everything. all of it or any part of it, namely reality. Because the choice to live is just the choice to accept the realm of reality. Now, if anybody says, now you see, that's a primary, you can't get beneath that, but are there grounds? What do you mean by grounds? If the total of reality is not a ground, tell me what a ground would be. I mean, what's left? If anybody says that's arbitrary, he's emptying the word arbitrary of any meaning, because arbitrary means it's detached from reality. But how can the total of reality be detached from reality? I mean, it's absurd. So these people that pose as, well, we have to have a proof of every point, and therefore a primary choice is arbitrary, if you know what the primary choice is and how it's related to the metaphysical fundamental of existence or as the primary, the very fact that that question could come up is itself an aberration. That question used to really annoy Mr. Rand, because I asked it about, oh, I would say every 2 months for about 10 years. And then I think the very end of 325 is one of the few places where I pay her a historic compliment in terms of her achievement. I do think that these last, second last paragraph is true, that it is the moral liberation of the human race and the possibility of life for the first time. And that is one of her immortal achievements. Okay, that's what I have to say on this chapter, and you've got now 11 unrestricted minutes. Okay.
I was wondering at the very beginning why you say, according to objectivism, code must deal with three basic questions.
I can't find the place. I can hear the sound. Oh, okay, yeah.
Right. Why it was necessary to put in the phrase, according to objectivism?
Well, I put it according to objectivism. Why did I say according to objectivism there are three basic questions? Because there are a lot of ethical codes that don't, ethical theories that won't accept one or all of those questions. For instance, if you're a Kantian, you will say your goals have nothing to do with ethics. Ethics is categorical imperatives. In effect, what we would call virtues, without reference to any consequences, regardless of whether they lead to something desirable or not. And therefore the idea of approaching ethics from the point of view of an end that you're trying to achieve, Kant would regard as intrinsically corrupt, you see. So he would say, certainly not. And then there's the reverse. There's people who say, ethics should tell you the end, but it's up to you to do what you please to get that end. Who are we to prescribe means? For instance, the most obvious is the sort of hedonist. You know, it says, eat, drink, and make merry, for tomorrow you die. Maximize your pleasure, that's the goal. What makes you, gives you pleasure? You know, one man's meat is another man's poison, good luck, and go ahead. Now, he would say, we should prove, and they give these laborious proofs, that pleasure is the ultimate goal, but as far as the means, that's nothing to do with ethics. And most people in the history of thought wouldn't even discuss beneficiary as a question, because they consider it self-evident that you should sacrifice. So the only debate over beneficiary was, you know, in the 16th and 17th centuries, whether it should be God or society. So for the first period, they thought it should be God, and in the next period, they thought it should be society. That isn't even discussed anymore. So it's only objectivism that says these are three questions to which you have to have provable answers. And nobody that I know that even raises those three questions. Well, I do indicate that Aristotle and Spinoza, in different ways, not as clearly, but in different ways, raised those three questions and had an answer, and an answer that's in many ways similar to objectivism. That is, they both held life, not in the way we would recognize exactly, but still significantly as a primary value. They both were staunch advocates of rationality, even though Spinoza is a pantheist and his idea of rationality is, you know, not what Ayn Rand's would be. And they were both egoists. Even though Spinoza had a mystical element in which, you know, you pursue yourself by blending with the total and so on. But you can find really good, if you want somebody good to read, I definitely recommend Spinoza. He's full of ideas that you'd swear he got from Atlas. Except the next sentence is, you know, a complete contradiction. But he's a really interesting philosopher.
On page 299, toward the bottom, you say remaining alive is the goal of all proper action.
Can't be 299.
Yes, 299.
Not in mine.
At the end of the section.
Oh, you're going to the preceding section. I see. Okay. At the bottom, I thought you meant the bottom of the paragraph. Okay.
Page 299.
Yes, I see it now. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Remaining alive is the goal of all proper action.
Right.
Yet on page 324, third from the bottom paragraph,
well, you're going to catch me.
Examples of where suicide would be proper action.
Right.
Can you reconcile those, please?
Sure. My reconciliation of this two statements. One, I said remaining alive is the goal of all proper action, and then I said suicide is okay. How can I reconcile that? Context. If I had to repeat everything as the background of every statement, you'd never get past the second statement because you'd have to keep repeating the first one, and then the first two, and after four sentences, you would break down. I am here stating a basic principle. Remaining alive is the goal of all proper action. I am not saying in every conceivable circumstance proper action is possible to you. I am saying wherever proper action is possible, by proper action I mean a course of action across time to sustain yourself, that's what you should do. But now, after I establish that as the foundation, remember, you can't discuss exceptions or side issues until you know what they're an exception to. It would be just as though I was giving advice on health, and I said, 5 minutes of aerobic activity a day is essential. And then 3 chapters later I said, people who have just had a heart attack should take 2 weeks off. And then you say, well, on page 299 you said 5 minutes a day. I say, well, now think what it would be hierarchically if I were to say, 5 minutes a day is essential. By the way, if you've had a heart attack, don't do it for 2 weeks. Now, if you have lung cancer, it's okay to do it for a week, but it depends what kind of smoke, you know, cigarettes, you could never function at all. You have to grasp a principle, knowing that it's contextual. And then as you develop, you specify the edges of the context, and then it's like what the spiral theory of knowledge. You come back to seeing the earlier formulation in a wider context, but you can't get to the later elaboration until you first state the principle. It does not mean the principle is wrong or oversimplified. There is no other way to think except to first think in the normal context and then adjust for conditions which come later. That is what is wrong with, if I can say so without hurting your feelings, with saying, on page A, you say da-da-da, and on page B, you say da-da-da. Maybe it's a contradiction, but it could also very well be that there's a change of context, you know. And because I did that very often to Miss Rand, I'd say, now you said so-and-so, and then you said so-and-so. And she was always, you know, very patient. She'd say, yeah, but you forgot that in between I said so-and-so. Oh. You know, but we were taught in graduate school that you just fish for any phrase and any other phrase and match them, you know. And if, you know, one is the formal contradiction of the other, you caught the philosopher and you got points, that's it. Now, you see, by that way, you can't think at all. Because when there was the epistemology workshop, there was an analyst professor there, and he used to say to Ayn Rand, now on page so-and-so of your book, you said, the concept is the word. And on page so-and-so, you said, the concept is not the word. The word, you know, symbolizes the concept. And then on page so-and-so you said the word completes the concept. Now, which is it? You know, and of course, you can imagine the answer that she gave him. Okay, I think we have time for...
This will be the last one.
Is egoism a corollary of... is selfishness a corollary of egoism?
No, is selfishness a corollary of egoism? I don't make a distinction between selfishness and egoism. I use them as simply Latin and Anglo-Saxon for the same concept. There are people who try to distinguish them, But Ayn Rand never did. There are literary contexts. Selfish has the more aggressive ring to it. So if you want to antagonize an audience, you call your book The Virtue of Selfishness. Egoism sounds less, aggressive because of the Latin, the classical connotation to it. But of course, ego has the same negative connotation to people of the outside camp, and self doesn't. So they would be, if you tell them they have no ego, they'd say, great. But if you say you have no self, they'd say, I certainly do, because you know you're supposed to. The quest for self is considered reputable, but you're supposed to shed your ego in the process. So it's a semantic thing, but I don't make any distinction. I use them. Similarly, I don't make any distinction between ethics and morality. Not that those words are the same as egoism and selfishness, but there are people who try to make a distinction, and there are contexts, you know, where moral is sterner than ethical. But I use them essentially interchangeably. And again, well, in that case, they both go back to the classical. So do we have one more? Or? Why not? After exhorting everybody to ask questions, I'm delighted to see that there's dozens of hands up. Yeah. A short one, because our time is...
You indicated that you had made some sort of decisions about some things you wanted to carry on and things you had discarded. Would you elaborate?
About things that I want?
You had come to some point of decision. That you had, there were some things you wanted to complete.
Yes, that's right.
Could you elaborate?
You really want to ask that question? Can I defer the answer to that question? And I'll promise you I will answer at some point. I'm not sure that with 30 seconds left, it's a good idea. So I will take this opportunity gracefully to thank you very much, and I'll see you all on Thursday. Thank you.